would be grateful for some reassurance that my unit is not crumbling around my ears. And you shall have it, sir. He nodded. I hope so. Why are you still here, Dr. Maxwell?
I'm waiting for you to instruct me to see to it, sir.
He smiled. See to it, Dr. Maxwell?
Yes, sir.
Number 4's inaugural assignment had been a small one, nothing too strenuous for what was literally its first date. Rushford, 1815, the post-Waterloo celebrations. Napoleon was no longer at large. The Iron Duke was a national hero. Relief and jubilation were sweeping across a country no longer at war. We would be on home ground, and I would be interested to see Rushford again, 415 years after my last visit. We'd jump there, monitor all the readings very carefully, take a quick tour around town, and come back out again, reproducing the conditions of the first jump as closely as possible. Then I'd push off to interview Prentice and Clerk again, and Leon and his team of techies would evaluate the pod and its performance. Easy peasy. We were dressed well. I wore a silk gown of pale blue with a matching bonnet, the same one I'd worn to George IV's coronation when Markham pimped me out to a clergyman. Cream gloves and matching half boots of kid completed my get-up, and my pepper spray, of course, tucked away in my pretty girly reticule. Peterson and I walked down to Hawking together. It was on the tip of my tongue to ask him whether this was what he and Leon had been discussing earlier, thus cunningly ascertaining how things stood between them, but that would mean bringing up other topics of conversation as well, such as what exactly I'd been doing behind his armchair, something for which I had yet to think of an acceptable and believable explanation that didn't involve massive toe-curling on my part and hilarity on his. So I left it. Leon looked very handsome in a navy coat and biscuit-coloured breeches, while Peterson struck a slightly dandified note in a high-crowned hat, green coat and cream waistcoat. He also carried a cane, all the better to whack them with, presumably. It was Peterson's mission, so he seated himself in the central seat and wriggled his bum a little. Problem? Said Leon, in what I hoped was normal defence of one of his beloved pods.
Not in the slightest. Hold on tight, everyone. Computer, initiate jump.
Jump initiated. The world went white. Chapter 35. The date was late July. Most of us had been to Waterloo, and Dr. Bairstow had insisted we leave a clear month between then and this jump. We landed down by the river. The dock area was downstream from the town itself, because upstream from Rushford, the river widened abruptly and became unnavigable. The port was considerably busier than in modern times. Tall-masted ships lined the quays, surrounded by swarms of shouting men either loading or unloading their cargoes. The warehouses were hives of activity, with bales and barrels being carried in through one door and out through another. Horse-drawn wagons waited in line to be loaded, and everywhere, rope-makers, chandlers, sailmakers, carpenters and sailors all surged about, shouting, gesturing and generally getting on with the business of the day. Peterson turned from the screen to Leon, already tapping away at his scratch pad and frowning at the results.
Anything?
Hmm?
No, nothing, as I anticipated. Well, according to their mission programme, they were to make their way up into town to suss out what was happening there. We'll leave you to it.
Hmm, said Leon, barely looking up. And they say we historians are obsessed.
5-minute progress reports, persevered Peterson.
Hmm. We left him to it. The smell of tar was overwhelming. Even the people reeked of it.
Jolly Jack Tars,
muttered Peterson. I nodded and did as other women were doing and rummaged in my reticule for a handkerchief to hold over my nose. We left the docks and emerged into the town. It was lovely to see the medieval bridge back in place. I wondered exactly when it had been built. After my departure, obviously, and now the town had spilled over the river and up the hill on the other side. The market was now held up near St. Stephen's. Many medieval buildings were still here. I recognised the Guildhall, almost completely unchanged. But now they were interspersed with Jacobean and Elizabethan buildings too. There were some imposing stone houses lining the streets.
Rushford was obviously booming. Because of the docks, I guessed. In modern times, the docks had dwindled, the warehouses had been converted into smart flats, trendy coffee shops had spawned where the chandlers and rope makers once worked, and right in the middle of it all, the council had commissioned a block of modern apartments, all plate glass and blue plastic, so everyone could see that Rushford was happy to throw away its heritage in favour of modern tat. Peterson always muttered under his breath and averted his eyes, as did most people who had to pass near it. The streets were still filthy, though. That hadn't changed at all. The dirt was knee-high in places. For a penny, small boys would sweep a crossing for their betters. Not having a penny, Peterson and I took our chances, dodging the very much increased volume of wheeled traffic which came at us from all directions. You really needed your wits about you here. There were even more inns than before. I put that down to the mail coaches. The cider tree, where William Hendred had stabled his horse the day we went to Rushford, was still here, although it was now greatly enlarged, and the frontage was different, with a huge archway through which the mail coaches swept in and out, blowing their horns for a change of horses. I smiled to myself and moved on. The crowds were thickest here, and we were jostled from all sides. Peterson linked his arm with mine to avoid us being swept apart. There were people shouting, drivers roaring at pedestrians to get out of the way, street cries, and the rumble of wheels on rough paving. We could hardly hear ourselves speak. It all happened very suddenly, but then unexpected things usually do. We had paused to listen to a street preacher, all wild eyes and waving arms, when a ragged street urchin, barefoot and terrified, burst out of the crowd, followed by a bellow of startled rage. He swerved, collided with a portly gentleman with a red face and a fancy waistcoat, who shouted with alarm and swung at him. His cane caught the boy around the head. The boy staggered and dropped something before disappearing back into the crowd. Whatever it was fell almost at my feet, and, like an idiot, I let go of Peterson's arm and picked it up. It was a gentleman's pocketbook. The urchin had attempted to steal it, been caught in the act, and had fled the scene, getting rid of the evidence as he went. This was not something in which I should get involved. I dropped it and kicked it away. Too late. Someone seized my arm, shouting, "Got her! Over here!" Cries rose up around me. Apparently I was a thieving doxy and transportation was too good for me. I was surrounded in no time at all. I strained for a sight of Peterson, who had been swept away in the turmoil, but my view was blocked by angry citizens at every turn. Someone pushed me. I fell against someone else, who pushed me the other way. My bonnet was knocked over my eyes, and then I couldn't see at all. At some point, I dropped my reticule, but it left my hands free, and I began to struggle. I kicked out and caught someone's shins. There was a muttered oath, and someone hit me across the face. For a brief moment, I heard Peterson's voice in my ear. "Max, stay!" And then another blow knocked out my earpiece. I didn't hear it fall, but it seemed safe to assume it had been trampled by the crowd. I was protesting my innocence, loudly and at length. From far away, I thought I could hear Peterson shouting at me, telling me to stay put. He was on his way. Too late. I was hustled away. I couldn't see where. I couldn't see anything. I remember slipping and sliding on the cobbles, and then being hustled down a flight of steps. A door slammed ominously behind me, shutting out the sounds of the angry crowd. I would have fallen down an unseen stair, but they held me tightly. I could tell I was inside a building, but the smell was dreadful. The sharp smell of urine and unwashed bodies stung my eyes and nose. It was underlaid with something else that turned my stomach. I remembered when I was at school, reading a report on the reforms of Elizabeth Fry, which described the women's wing of Newgate Prison as hell on earth. This wasn't Newgate, thank God, but it still wasn't a good place to be. My bonnet was dragged off my head, bringing my hair down with it. I looked down at my dress, splattered with the filth of the streets and torn where I'd caught my foot in the hem. It was going to be very difficult to convince the authorities I was a respectable wife and mother. A man in a shabby dark coat stood at a high wooden desk, inscribing something in a book. His tongue protruded as he laboriously constructed his letters. His teeth looked like splayed tombstones on a dark night. I said, I think there's been some mistake. And the man on my right, a fat old bugger with a straining waistcoat, said,
You don't speak.
Turning to the man at the desk, he said, Thieving jade, caught in the act. The man dipped his pen in a cup of brown, muddy ink and began to write, slowly and with great precision.
What was stolen? Gentleman's pocketbook. Does she still have it?
That, of course, was their cue to run their very grubby hands all over me. They knew I didn't have it, but any excuse.
Passed it on to an accomplice. Saw her do it. What's her name?
They shrugged.
Take your pick.
I said quickly, My name is Mrs. Farrell. My husband is Leon Farrell, Esquire, of St. Mary's Priory. When they'd stopped laughing, they took great pleasure in informing me St. Mary's was let to Captain Jessop and his family, currently sojourning in Bath for the summer. Then they realised that if I was part of a gang, they'd just told me the house was empty and clipped my ear, presumably, to induce deafness. And indeed, on top of the blows I'd already received, my head was beginning to ring. I'd been out of sick bay less than a week, and look at the state of me already. Tombstone Teeth, obviously the thinker of the outfit, was regarding me dubiously.
Are you sure? Seems a well-dressed mort to me. Likely stole those as well. Anything else on her?
Back they came with their hands. Time to put a stop to this. I drew myself up and summoned every ounce of hauteur that I could muster. You, sirs, will kindly desist. When my husband hears of this outrage, it is you who will be answering to the magistrates, not I. The hands paused.
Cor, listen to her, said someone. Good as a play.
But I noticed the hands did not recommence. I told myself a seed of doubt had been sown, and Leon and Peterson were out there somewhere. They'd get me out. I was hustled down some more steps. Someone ahead jangled their keys, and there was the sound of a wooden door scraping across a stone floor. I was pushed forwards, slipped in something slimy, and fell onto my knees in a pile of wet straw. Behind me, a man laughed and said,
Not so hoity-toity now, are you, my fine lady?
And the door slammed shut behind me. Darkness and silence enveloped me. I waved my hand around but couldn't see anything. There was no window and no light. I crouched and felt around, which wasn't pleasant. You'll never guess what I put my hand in. I wiped it as best as I could on my skirts. Mrs. Enderby was not going to be pleased with me. My outstretched arm found a wet wall. Brick, I guessed. I took a tentative step forward and then another. There's no direct evidence for a sixth sense, but we have it just the same. I don't know what made me stop and stand still, but I did. I stood stock still for a long time, uselessly turning my head from side to side, trying to discover what wasn't right, why I'd stopped. A blast of cold air lifted the short hairs around my face. Cold, fetid air. Surely not. I felt around with my feet, very, very carefully. Even though I was expecting it, I very nearly overbalanced, and that wouldn't have done me any good at all, because there was nothing there. Just a nothingness from which an evil smell arose. The floor gaped before me. I stood on the brink of a pit. God knows how deep it was, and I certainly wasn't going to check. I didn't think it was that deep. At least I hoped it wasn't that deep, because I suspected this was a bit of a joke. Payback for me doing the posh bint thing. That was why they hadn't left me with a light. I would grope my way around, fall down the hole, flounder around in whatever lay at the bottom, going through the motions, as Markham would say, and present myself at the next sessions dripping with God knows what and earning an automatic one-way ticket to Australia. I wouldn't be surprised if this wasn't a cell at all. This might be somewhere they shoved the stroppy prisoners to teach them a lesson. Was this why I was here alone when 19th-century prisons were famous for their overcrowding? I shuffled very carefully to one side, found the wall again, kicked aside what I hoped was wet straw, and lowered myself slowly to the floor. I made myself as small as possible, drawing up my knees in much the same position I'd been in behind Peterson's armchair only a few hours ago. Another place, another time.
I suppose it was some form of primitive sensory deprivation. I sat in the silent darkness and lost all sense of time and space. I had no idea how long I'd been there. It could have been anything from 20 minutes to several hours. I tried to count my breaths to give me an idea of passing minutes and kept losing count. I told myself it didn't matter. As soon as it was dark, if not before, Leon and Peterson would be here. They'd get me out, and we could return to our investigations. Despite the damp stone, it was very warm in here. Every time I moved, I felt my clothes sticking to me. My forehead prickled with sweat. I kept wiping it away, forgetting to keep my dirty hands away from my face, but it was so hot. I leaned my head back against the cool, wet wall, but it didn't help. I was going down with something. The symptoms had come on too quickly for jail fever, although that would be something to put on my CV, and would certainly stop Peterson in his tracks every time he started on about his twinge of bubonic plague. Time passed. My head began to throb. And then I felt sick. Whether because of the headache, I don't know. I stared into the darkness and tried to tell myself this would soon be over. Leon and Peterson would come. They didn't. And the doubts crept in. Suppose they couldn't find me? Suppose Peterson hadn't followed me back to this jail? Suppose he and Leon only took a cursory look around, decided I was somewhere else, and went off and left me here? I'd been locked up for hours and hours. Surely they should have been here by now. Either bribing the jailers, or if that didn't work, then intimidating them, or if that didn't work, then blowing the place sky high and pulling me out from under the rubble. And then I had an even worse thought. Had Peterson been arrested too? Were we both incarcerated in this place, and Leon didn't have a clue where we were? Would I ever see them again? I stared into the dark. Would I ever see anything again? A tiny voice said, "We're St. Mary's, and we never leave our people behind." But I'd been left behind in 1399. I'd only been back at St. Mary's for a week, and now I'd been left behind again. Unbelievably, I think I might have dozed off. I'm not sure. Just for a few seconds, anyway. I only know I woke with a jerk. I hadn't even thought of it until it actually happened. I'd been sitting here for hours, and in all that time, there hadn't been a single sound, so I'd assumed I was alone. Somewhere to my left, the straw rustled. I held my breath. Someone was in here with me. Fresh sweat broke out all over my body, prickling my hair and running down my back. My instinct was to stand up, to face whatever it was, and defend myself. Second thoughts kept me where I was. It was equally dark for both of us. Sitting here against the wall, I was a smaller target than if I was standing. I kept very, very still and listened until my ears nearly fell off. Nothing. I heard nothing. Was it possible I'd imagined it? And then I thought, idiot, it's a rat. Of course it is. The place would be riddled with them. They probably nipped in and out through the hole in the floor, which was probably some sort of open drain. I leaned back against the cool wall and closed my eyes in relief. I wasn't old or infirm or sick. I was in no danger. I could deal with a rat or two. The straw rustled again, in exactly the same place. I froze and held my breath, straining all my senses. And then it happened again, a little closer this time. This was not a rat scuttling around my cell. This was something slowly drawing nearer, an inch at a time. I'd lost my reticule with my pepper spray inside. I had no means of defending myself against whatever was in here with me. I don't know why I thought something rather than someone, but I did. My eyes were stinging. Sweat was pouring off me. I was dreadfully thirsty. My head ached fit to burst. And something was in here with me. The straw rustled again, very close this time. I was convinced I could hear breathing. This was no rat. I had a sudden picture of something climbing out of the hole in the floor, silent and menacing, something that could see in the dark, whereas I was blind, something that would stalk me around this tiny space. Something from which I could not escape. I was gasping for breath, panic, fear, the heat. I couldn't breathe properly. My head was throbbing. If I'd had time to eat before I left, Then it would have been all across the floor by now. I could hear breathing. I swear I could hear breathing. Long, slow, and heavy. And I could smell something. Even over the robust aromas of a 19th-century prison cell, I could smell decaying earth. My mind flew back to another small space, when I was trapped in a pod with Cal and we were fighting something that would not die. Had it found me again? I couldn't sit still any longer. I struggled to my feet and stood swaying, keeping one hand on the wall for support. The straw rustled again and a voice breathed, "I see you." I screamed, and at exactly that moment the cell door opened. It was only a feeble light, but it stabbed at my eyes and did my splitting headache no good at all. I heard men's voices, and Leon said, "I've got you, Max." I tried to warn him, "There's something here, something dangerous." "Yes," he said grimly, "me." Chapter 36. I was convinced I had jail fever.
"No, no, no," said Peterson. "Nothing as classy as jail fever. You just picked up some horrible nameless infection that will probably kill you. Nothing to worry about."
He was fussing around with the med kit. Leon was laying a welcome cold cloth on my forehead. My temperature was about 180. You could have boiled a kettle on me. Our medications are colour-coded for safety. It's quite simple, really. Blue and green can be used with each other. Orange can be used with green, but not with blue. Red can only be used on its own and not with any other colour. Simple. We have to do this because we carry a bewildering array of drugs to counteract the bewildering array of diseases an historian can contract if she really puts her mind to it. I had two blues and a green.
"Pretty," I said groggily, admiring the colours.
Peterson rolled his eyes. "How are you feeling?" asked Leon. I looked around. I was back in the pod with no memory of how I'd got there, but I wasn't in jail, so I didn't really care. Speaking of which, did you see it?
"See what?"
said Leon, reapplying the cloth. "See what was in the cell with me."
"There was nothing in the cell with you."
"Did it escape through the hole?"
"What hole?"
"The hole in the floor," I said impatiently. He said quietly, "There was no hole in the floor."
"Yes, there was,"
I said, becoming quite cross with him. "I felt it with my foot, or rather I didn't feel it with my foot, if you know what I mean." "Max, there was no hole and no one else. You were on the floor in a perfectly normal 10x4 room."
"No, I wasn't,"
I said, trying to sit up so I could put him right.
"Yes, you were," said Peterson, putting the med kit away. "You were on the floor rabbiting on about God knows what and as high as a kite."
"No, I wasn't," I said again, getting angry now because they were both completely wrong. "I wasn't there all that long." They exchanged glances.
"You were there overnight."
"No, I wasn't."
"Was I?"
"Yes. It took us that long to get you out. They wouldn't let you go without a magistrate's signature, and it took us all night to track one down."
"I thought you'd blow up the jail," I said, disappointed.
"That was Plan B," said Leon gravely.
"And they let me go?"
"Once they realised you were the wife of a respectable citizen, they couldn't wait to get rid of you," said Peterson. "My heart went out to them."
"I don't feel very well," I said plaintively.
"No," said Leon, "but the antibiotics will kick in, and you'll be fine in the morning." He got that wrong. We all spent a lively night. I awoke with a fit of coughing and couldn't stop. I remember Peterson running his long fingers over the med kit before saying, "I think we'll try this one, and this one." Shadows came and went. I asked Leon if he'd found the problem with the pod, and my mind slithered away before he could reply. I drank vast amounts of water. Dark dreams danced before my eyes before at long last the meds kicked in and I fell properly asleep. I awoke to a silent pod. Peterson was stretched out in a sleeping module and Leon was sitting at the console, scratch pad in hand, frowning at a readout. Everything was peaceful and quiet. My fever had gone. And then, to my right, a locker door swung open and there stood Clive Ronan. Fresh from the Egyptian desert. I could clearly see sand caught in the creases of his jeans and T-shirt. A little pile of it had collected around his feet. He was still wearing his bandana. He was standing there, in the locker, with my baby in his arms. Matthew was holding out his little arms to me. I had to save him because somehow I'd been given a second chance. A chance to save my little Matthew. I tried to kick my legs free so I could get up. A huge weight bore down on me. Someone was shouting. They wouldn't let me get up, and I had to save Matthew. I was shouting. Someone was shouting back again. I couldn't move. Clive Ronan grinned at me, and the locker door closed. He was gone, taking my baby with him. I screamed and kicked. Something pricked my arm, and I went back to sleep. I opened my eyes. Leon and Peterson were sitting at the console, talking quietly. I said, "Hey," and they both turned around. Leon got up and knelt stiffly at my side. "Max, do you know where you are?" I tried to get up. "Did you see him? Did you see Ronan? We have to get after him." He gently pushed me back again. "You're hallucinating, Max." I had to make him understand. "No, he was here. He was in the locker over there. He had Matthew. We can still catch him. We can get our baby back." At the console, Peterson made a sound and turned away. Leon pushed my hair out of my eyes. "Sweetheart, you're dreaming. It's not real. You have a fever."
"No, I don't," I said, coughing up a lung. "I'm fine."
He passed me some water. "We're going to get you back to St. Mary's and let Dr. Stone take a look at you." "No, we're not," said Peterson quietly. Leon turned impatiently. "It's no good looking like that, Leon. We've been over this. You know the rules as well as I. Whatever Max has, we can't take it back with us. We wait until she's better." "It's been 2 days. She's not getting any better."
"2 days? Really?"
"She will. We just have to find the right meds. I tell you, we should go back, declare a code blue, and let Dr. Stone sort it out." "Out of the question," said Peterson quietly, and turned back to the console. There was a rather nasty silence, and then Leon said, "Just because you've lost Helen doesn't mean I'm going to lose Max." Peterson turned slowly from the console, and his face was... "No.
No, 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 this wasn't happening."
He took a deep breath and his voice was too calm. "Leon, I'm not risking St. Mary's, and possibly the rest of the world, just for one person. The rules are clear. We stay put."
"Until she's dead or better?"
"Until she's dead or better, yes." I lay still and watched them argue, hoping, praying this was another hallucination. But it wasn't. I watched their mouths open and close. There was the strangest sense of déjà vu. Had I done this before? Had this happened before? I tried to kick my sluggish brain into action. Yes. Yes, it had. A long time ago in the future, two men had argued over a sick woman with catastrophic results. People had died, and continued to die to this very day. I tried to speak, and was overtaken by yet another coughing fit. Peterson brought me some water. Leon snatched it off him. I remember sipping something cold and closing my eyes, just for a minute. I awoke to raised voices. They were shouting. Two men who never shouted were shouting now. Shadows danced before my eyes. Did we carry a gun? There's a lockbox in one of the lockers for any weapons we feel we might need, which we don't very often. We're not allowed to shoot contemporaries, although the rules about shooting each other are less stringent. I should do something. I should ignore my temperature, my sweats and shakes and double vision, and deal with the situation. Before it got out of hand, before someone died. Too late. I heard the sounds of a scuffle. Something broke, a mug, I guessed. There was grunting and the sound of a blow. This was a nightmare, a waking nightmare. What might they do to each other? Could an event repeat itself before it had actually happened? They fell against the locker in a tangle of arms and legs. I rolled out of the way before I was trampled. Under the console seemed a good idea. I could see feet and legs, and everything was slipping away again. "Max? Max, talk to me." I opened my eyes. It was just me and Leon. Peterson was nowhere to be seen. I peered out from under the console, but it wasn't that big a pod. Peterson definitely wasn't here. I'd been hot, and now I turned cold. Leon tried to help me out.
What are you doing under there?
Not being trampled. Where's Peterson?
Outside.
I froze and then tried to squeeze further back under the console.
What have you done?
He sat back in surprise.
Nothing. What do you think I've done?
A long time ago in the future, a man had shot his friend, thrown him out of the pod, and abandoned him to die. I opened my mouth to give utterance to the unthinkable and then stopped.
Leon, what's this?
What's what? Will you come out from under there?
Leon, there's something under here.
Yes, you. Come out, Max, please. I was almost completely entangled in my sweat-drenched sheet. I struggled feebly and got nowhere.
Here.
He pulled me out. I was too weak to be of any assistance, and even not assisting brought me out in another sweat. The door opened, and Peterson appeared in the doorway. He had a cut on his cheekbone, and now I could see Leon clearly. His lip was split, and he had a slight bruise over one eye. They looked at each other.
Leon said, "Come back for more."
His tone was ugly. Peterson's lips curled.
"Beating up a sick old man is just too easy."
I said, "What's going on?"
No one was listening to me. The atmosphere was thick and toxic.
Yes, it was, wasn't it? Toxic was exactly the word to describe it. I rolled back under the console.
Leon!
They still weren't listening. At any moment they'd start circling each other. I reached up and pulled. It came away with a slight reluctance that told me it might be magnetized.
Leon said, "What are you doing?"
And at the same moment Peterson said, "What's that?" I held it up. Leon snatched it off me.
"For God's sake, Max, it could have been fitted with an anti-tamper device."
"It's an air freshener," I said woozily. "Surely blowing up is slightly counterproductive."
"Actually," said Peterson, scooping me up and dropping me back on the sleeping module, "when it comes to thinking, Max, you might want to leave the heavy lifting to us men."
"Yeah, you've both been such a stunning success at it so far, haven't you?" Leon laid it down carefully and disappeared under the console again.
"Open the door."
"Why?"
"Because I'm shutting down the ventilation system."
"Why?"
"My turn this time."
"Because we're being drugged." I suspect my feelings of dislike for Peterson, justified though they are, have been chemically induced, as was Max's Ronan hallucination.
"You mean I'm not ill?"
"No, you're very ill, but you've been drugged too. We all have."
Even as he spoke, the little air freshener gave a tiny squirt, releasing something into the air.
"Peterson, get a container, something airtight."
Peterson seized the medkit and upended the contents onto the floor. Leon dropped the air freshener inside and sealed the lid. We all peered at it as fresh, cool air blew gently into the pod. Peterson went to stand by the door. We never leave an open door unguarded, and breathed deeply. No one spoke for a very long time until he said,
"Well, what do you know? My very reasonable desire to strangle Leon is slowly beginning to fade."
"That's good," I said, "because my urge to bang your stupid heads together is increasing with every second," and closed my eyes to let them sort things out between them. We stayed for another 24 hours. I didn't do a lot. I just lay around looking feverish.
"I think," said Leon, reading the temp tape, "it's safe to take you back."
He showed the reading to Peterson, who said, "I agree." There was no hostility or aggression. They were exactly as they'd always been.
Leon caught me watching them and put his hand on mine.
"It's fine, Max, really."
I was too tired to argue.
"At least if you've had jail fever, you're excused report writing." Both Leon and Peterson said anything I reported would be wildly inaccurate anyway. Apparently, I'd been in my own world most of the time, imagining all sorts of things, they said, not looking at each other, and I agreed that yes, I'd imagined all sorts of things. The canister was sent off to Professor Rapson, who reported that it contained a mutated form of DMT, or Dimitri, as he called it, a drug quite easy to manufacture and known for its abilities to induce hallucinations, to give nightmares shape and form, he said. They had to restrain him from knocking some up there and then just to demonstrate. And yes, before anyone asked, there were fingerprints all over the canister. Mine, Leon's, and Peterson's, so that wasn't very helpful. Dieter gave number four a clean bill of health. Every other pod was rigorously searched by both the techies and the security section. No one found anything at all. The three of us were shoved into the isolation ward together, which was apparently to be known in future as the Maxwell Ward. Dr. Bairstow spoke individually to Cox, Prentice, and Clerk, and then left them alone together. I've no idea what their personal crisis had been. They never said, and no one ever asked. We didn't say much about ours either. I know that Leon and Peterson had a long and quiet talk together one night when they thought I was asleep. I'm not saying anything about that either, so don't ask. Incident closed. Mostly. Peterson was discharged first, Dr. Stone informing him that he appeared to be disappointingly normal and he would therefore appreciate him ceasing to lower the tone of his sick bay and to regard himself as expelled. Leon was also given permission to depart, but offered the option to remain with me since I was detained at Dr. Stone's pleasure for another 24 hours. It was up to him. He took up the option, returning to his own corner of the ward, not looking at me. When you have so many things to talk about, where do you begin? Who makes the first move? I watched the door close behind Peterson, and then got off my bed and went over to him. My poor Leon, wounded in just about every way it was possible to be hurt. I said very gently, "Leon, how are you feeling?" He stayed silent, looking everywhere but at me, before finally saying, "Not wonderful." "Great, now I've made my husband cry." "Yes, well, he's not doing that well these days." "Oh, I don't know, he's not doing too badly." "He's a bit of an idiot." I snorted. "He's a complete idiot," and took his hands. Eventually he cleared his throat and said, "I have something I want to say, Max."
"There's no need."
"I think there is."
"Okay then, off you go."
"I was thinking about the first time I ever saw you." He smiled slightly. "My heart fell right out of my chest, and I've been looking for it ever since. Do you remember those days? They were good times, Max." He paused for a moment, not looking at me. "I'd give anything to have those days again. I don't know how things could go so badly wrong between us. It's my fault, I know. I'm not completely recovered from my injuries, and things aren't good for me, but I can't blame everything on that. You know, Max, I don't always have the words to say what I should be saying, but I think what I'm saying is..." He fell silent.
"Yes?"
I said, wondering what revelation was about to smack me in the face this time. "I think we should reboot to the factory setting."
I wondered if I was having some sort of relapse.
"What?" "I think we should go back to that day, the day we first met. We remember how we felt about each other, and I ask you to be generous and forget everything else. Because it's not important. We're what's important. What do you say?" I couldn't say anything, so he lifted me onto his bed, thereby contravening every rule known to man and Dr. Stone. He rested his head on mine, and we held on to each other, because sometimes you don't need words. 24 hours later, we were both discharged. Apparently, they were sick of the sight of us. We were given to understand that we were never to darken their doors again. I had a compulsory 48 hours leave imposed upon me, as if it was some sort of gift. We nodded meekly and departed. Leon escorted me back to our room, with me complaining every inch of the way. I'd only just begun to touch on the world's injustices in general, and to me in particular, when we met Peterson and Dottle on the gallery on their way to a meeting. I stiffened warily, but he and Leon greeted each other normally. Miss Dottle was clutching an armful of files.
"We're putting together a new funding proposal," she said,
looking excited and happy at the prospect because, of course, being with Peterson had nothing to do with it. We wished them luck and watched them disappear into his office. Leon said, "What do you think?" I sighed.
I don't know. I suddenly realized I had mixed feelings. She's not Helen.
No one's Helen.
I know, it's just she's so different.
That may not necessarily be a bad thing. And does it matter as long as she makes him happy?
He looked down at me.
We can't help who we fall in love with.
I broke our self-imposed rule about not touching if we were in uniform and took his arm.
I know. And if she does make him happy?
I think she does. She's soft and gentle and earnest, and she worships him. I'm not saying it will last, but I think that as the person to help him get over Helen, he couldn't do better.
I looked up at him.
What was he saying?
People take comfort where they can, Max. We've both done that. There's no blame attached. No one blames anyone for it.
He looked at me. Do they?
It was as if a great weight had fallen away.
No, I said. No one blames anyone for anything.
Chapter 37 Leon made me a mug of tea before pushing off.
Thank you. My husband is wonderful.
Your husband has had it made abundantly clear to him that his duties are manifest and varied, and not confined solely to rocking his wife's world on a regular basis.
Nevertheless, his wife is grateful.
Enjoy your leave, he said, limping towards the door. Stay here, don't break anything. In particular, don't catch anything, just sit quietly and recover. Drink your tea, read a book, and stay out of trouble.
I sighed, but he just laughed and disappeared out of the door, promising to meet me for dinner.
I picked up a book. 17 minutes later, I was bored stiff. Don't get me wrong, it was a pleasant morning. The sun was shining through the windows, and I could hear the gentle background hum of others working. It was just, I don't know, my book was failing to grip me. I could go for a walk, a healthy way to spend a morning, and with the additional bonus of annoying all the people who'd been telling me to take things easy. Tempting, but I couldn't be bothered. I looked around. Matthew would be back with us soon. I could get his room ready. I'd been away so long and so much had happened. This time last month, I'd been discussing setting a trap for Ronan, and he'd set one for me instead. I pushed that thought away because I was supposed to be convalescing, and tried to remember if Matthew had clean sheets or not. I changed them anyway. Dusted his room, made sure his time map plug-in was working, and tidied his drawers, because he'd really appreciate that, wouldn't he? Back in our bedroom, I sorted my own clothes, which didn't take long because I don't have many, but, on the other hand, I hadn't seen them for quite a long time. Moving into our sitting room, I tidied briefly, even though there wasn't much to do. Both Leon and I are very neat. I straightened our books, plumped a few cushions, and that was it. I looked at the clock. That had taken 23 minutes. Long hours stretched ahead of me. I'm not good with time off. I flung myself onto my very recently plumped cushions and looked around for something else to do. Two teddies grinned at me. Bear T.0, Leon's gift to me during a very dark time, and Matthew's blue teddy, looking slightly the worse for wear and rather letting the side down. Now would be an ideal opportunity to clean him up, ready for Matthew's visit. I filled the wash basin with warm water, added a tiny drop of shampoo, and dropped him in. The water turned a horrible murky brown. He was a lot dirtier than he looked. Pale blue, while pretty, is not a good colour for a child's teddy. I left him to soak while I chucked some cleaning stuff down the loo, wiped down the bath and put out some clean towels. Job done, I went back to Matthew's teddy, lifting it, dripping, from the basin, and because there's something disquieting about treating a teddy bear like an old dishcloth, I closed my eyes before squeezing hard. Ouch, that hurt. I wrung it out again, and yes, there was definitely something there. Gingerly, I felt around. There was something inside his head. Something sharp. I held him up to the light. His eyes weren't level, but they never had been. Now I looked more closely, though. They weren't the same. One was slightly darker than the other. The slightly darker one was... not an eye. I didn't hesitate. I found an old scalpel in my painting gear and set to work. It didn't take long. Something small, round and dark rolled into the basin.
A good job I'd put the plug in, or it would have gone straight down the plug hole. I stared at it because I'm an idiot. All I could think was that Matthew had had this as a baby, and it was a stupid thing to put in a teddy bear destined for an infant. I wouldn't have thought it of Dottle. There was no blinding moment of revelation. I wasn't Saul on the road to Damascus with a donkey in a bright light. I was a small, tired, unintentionally underweight, emotionally battered historian staring at something I didn't understand and struggling to get myself together as random thoughts and impressions and memories all ran together like pools of mercury. This was how Ronan knew Matthew was in sick bay the day he killed Helen and stole him away. As a baby, Matthew had loved his teddy. It went everywhere with him. Ronan would have known exactly where he was at all times. And murdering Helen had been a snatched opportunity to harm us all, me and Peterson in particular. This was how Ronan knew when and where to intercept me the day I left St. Mary's on maternity leave. I saw my little box of possessions, the pale blue teddy sticking out of the top. This was how Ronan knew he would find me in the reed beds that day I went running. I heard her voice asking me, "Where are you off to?" I'd told her where I was going, and guess who turned up 30 minutes later with his offer of an olive branch? He'd said, "I've met someone." Was it her? Was it Lisa Bloody Dottle? This was how Ronan knew I'd had a boy. What had he said? He'd said, "And how is the little lad? Does he look like his father?" This was how Ronan knew we were waiting for him at Persepolis. Leon and I had discussed my plan here in this very room. This was how Ronan had been able to stay one step ahead of us all this time. I looked again at the device lying in the basin, and I knew. I just knew. Lisa Dottle. Lisa Bloody Dottle. There had been that incident in the canteen when she first arrived here, when her supposed boss, the idiot Halcombe, had publicly humiliated her. We'd sympathised with her and hated him. How easy it would have been for her to organise that and make herself the victim. We'd all felt so sorry for her, and again, when her hamster died. Was it even possible she'd killed it herself, as part of her cover? What sort of person would do that? Then there was the night we'd been burying King John's treasure up in the woods, when something very unpleasant was right behind us and we couldn't get into the pod, because every time we opened the door, she slapped it closed again, claiming later it had been panic-stricken inexperience. And the time in the sunken garden, when Ellis and I had been discussing our plan to trap Ronan here, Dottle had overheard every word and then, unable to get away quickly enough when she heard me coming, had flung herself over a bench and burst into tears. She'd been lucky enough to have Halcombe to cry about, but it could easily have been something else. Peterson and her unrequited love for him, perhaps. And that was why she hadn't pressed to accompany us to Persepolis, because with no historians or Dieter around, and Leon only part-time, that would have been the ideal opportunity for her to plant the canister of gas in number 4. Magnetised so no fitting skills required. She'd just wandered into Hawking one day, files and excuses all prepared in case anyone challenged her, but no one ever did because it was only Lisa Bloody Dottle. She'd waited until the busy techies were looking elsewhere, nipped into number 4, and just shoved it under the console. 10 seconds, tops. All ready to go as soon as the pod was in service. If I hadn't rolled under the console and discovered it, who knew what damage it would have done? Had already done. Clark, Prentice, Cox, Mead, Leon, Peterson, techies servicing the pod, dear God. No wonder nothing ever went right for us. I was pacing about like a madwoman. Was it possible that the only reason Matthew was still safe at TPHQ was because I'd accidentally left his teddy behind and he'd been too busy with his new life to ask for it? His teddy had been sitting on the windowsill ever since. Our windowsill. In our room. There's little enough privacy at St. Mary's, but this room was our space. The place we could be together. I thought of some of the things Leon and I had said to each other in this room, some of the things we'd done in this room, and felt hot purple rage in my heart. My instinct was to get rid of it as quickly as possible, so I did. I crossed to the front window and hurled it as hard and as far as I could, slamming the window closed again afterwards, as if that would make any difference, because the damage was done.
She'd played the victim and we'd fallen for it. We'd taken her in, included her, made her welcome and talked in front of her. Typical St. Mary's, a bloody great threat hanging over us like the sword of Damocles, and all this time we'd been looking in the wrong direction. Bloody typical. She must be laughing her bloody socks off, because the biggest threat wasn't the idiot Halcombe, and never had been. I wondered if the two of them were working together, or whether he'd been as used as we had. She'd never been working for him, but had he been working for her? He'd wandered around the building, making himself obnoxious on every possible occasion, far too obnoxious. He hadn't made the slightest effort to build a working relationship. He'd gone at it with all the delicacy of a bull in a china shop. He'd deliberately sabotaged the Caernarfon jump, trying to convince a bunch of historians, all of whom knew better, that he might have contracted leprosy. How eagerly we'd seized on what we saw as an opportunity to lock him in the isolation ward and count ourselves safe, threat neutralised. And all this time, he hadn't been the threat. He'd never been the threat, knowingly or unknowingly. He'd been working for Dottle, someone clever enough to lead from the back, someone discreet, someone who presented herself as slightly pathetic and very definitely non-threatening, someone we regarded with a very unhealthy mixture of affection, pity and slight contempt, someone who'd been laughing her head off at us ever since she walked through the door. Lisa Bloody Dottle. We'd been so taken in by her pink nose, her shyness, her apparent ability to blush at will, and her schoolgirl crush on Peterson. We'd separated her from Halcombe, welcomed her into our ranks, talked in front of her, and never for one moment thought. Overcoming the urge to hunt her down and kill her in the most painful way possible, I made myself a cup of tea and sat down to think. Barely had I taken the first sip when someone knocked at the door. I was in such a state that for one moment I was convinced it was Dottle herself. Had she discovered my discovery? I wrenched the door open. It wasn't her. It was Markham, aggrieved and slightly wet. "I was walking along minding my own business," he said indignantly, "and this fell on my head. Don't we keep Bashford for that sort of thing?" He held out Matthew's now one-eyed teddy. I thought quickly, "Oh my God, are you all right?" "No, I'm bloody not. It gave me a nasty shock. I was talking to the teddy. But while you're here, come in a moment." "Why are you hurling teddies out of the window anyway?" he said, closing the door behind him. "Who does that?" "I washed it," I said, ever so casually, because anyone might be listening. "And when I put it on the windowsill to dry, it fell out. I'm so glad you're here. Can you..." I had a quick think. "Get the lid off this for me. It seems to be stuck." He's really not an idiot, you know. "Okay," he said slowly. "Show me." I led him into the bathroom and pointed. "Look at that. Can you do anything?" He bent and peered closely, and then looked back at the one-eyed teddy he was still clutching. He worked it out considerably more quickly than I had done. I saw him remember who gave me the teddy, put two and two together, and arrive at the correct answer. Waggling his eyebrows, he made a winding motion with one hand. "Oh, yes, I think so." He grabbed a can of air freshener, grunted realistically, and pulled off the cap. "There you go. Another triumph for the security section. Anyway, I thought I'd take you for a spot of lunch. I expect you're having a really boring morning, aren't you?" "Worst ever," I said. "Let's go." I picked up the device, wrapped it in a thick towel, shoved it and the teddy into my sports bag, and we left. Out on the landing, I whispered, "Do you think it's still working?" "Well, dunking it in water won't have done it a lot of good, but assume it is." "What is it? Is it a camera?" "I don't think so. And even if it was, then the field of vision would be very limited. But it's definitely a listening device." "Range?" "Unknown, but the techies will be able to tell us." "Deep breaths, Max." "I'm slightly annoyed." "Suck it up." "Okay. Is she still with Peterson?" He pulled out his scratch pad and tapped. "According to her diary, she's with him for another 30 minutes. Let's leave her there. You talk to Dr. Bairstow and I'll get my team together." I clutched his arm. "She mustn't get away." "She won't," he said reassuringly.
Go. Mrs. Partridge was sitting at her desk.
Good morning, Mrs. Partridge. May I leave this here, please?
I waited for her to assimilate my scruffy bag and say no, but there must have been something in my face because she said immediately,
Of course.
She opened the bottom drawer of her filing cabinet and I stuffed it in, slamming the drawer shut afterwards.
Please don't let anything happen to that.
She nodded.
I need to see him urgently.
She nodded again and I went straight in. I gave it to him in as few words as possible. When I'd finished, he said,
Where is the device now?
Mrs. Partridge has it safely stowed away. He nodded and then sat silently for a very long time, staring at his desk. I too sat quietly. The urge to do something violent now, right this very minute, was slowly subsiding, to be replaced by the urge to get it right.
She is with Dr. Peterson, I believe.
Yes, sir.
There was a tap at the door and Markham entered.
I've cleared the hall, sir, and locked the doors to R&D. The front doors are secured. Chief Farrell has Hawkin on lockdown. We're ready to go whenever you give the word. Where do you want her?
In here, I think, Mr. Markham, with no less than two of your men with her at all times, armed, of course, and another two men outside.
Agreed, sir. One in Mrs. Partridge's room, with her permission, of course, and the other out on the gallery guarding the outer door.
Very well, Mr. Markham. Go and get her. I have a letter to write.
Chapter 38. I went with Markham and his team out to the gallery and was all set to follow him to Peterson's office when he drew me aside.
No.
What?
I don't want you there, Max.
But it was me that...
That's true, and I'm grateful, but you've done your bit. I've no idea how this will go down, but you will keep your distance. I don't want her grabbing you as a hostage or anything like that, and if she shoots you, then Leon will come looking for me. You can wait and watch, but from the other side of the gallery. No closer than 20 feet, Max. If you won't agree, then you can wait with Dr. Bairstow, who incidentally trusts us to get on with the job ourselves.
I reluctantly stepped back.
Okay.
They waited while I trailed around the gallery until I was opposite Peterson's office. Then they pulled out their weapons and moved in. Markham went in first, closely followed by Evans and Cox. Galaccio and Keller covered them from the door, and the rest waited on either side of the corridor. They were quick and professional. I heard her scream,
oh my God, what's happening?
And through the open door, I watched her attempt to jump out of her seat. Markham pushed her back again, his gun in her face.
Dr. Peterson, sir, if you would be so good.
I caught a glimpse of Peterson as he stared at this invasion in astonishment. Then he pushed back his chair. Keeping his distance, he edged away along the wall, taking care to stay out of their line of fire. He was 3/4 turned away from me, and I couldn't see his face. The next minute, they had her out of the chair, and she was face down on the carpet while they secured her hands. Then they had an arm each and were dragging her out of the door. I was very good. I stayed safely on my side of the gallery, but she turned her head and saw me standing there. It was astonishing. This wasn't the same Dottle at all, and now I realised what a very clever woman she was. Suddenly, don't ask me how, she wasn't so hunched, her nose wasn't so pointed, her hair wasn't so ratty. She straightened up, tossed her hair out of her face, looked across at me and smiled. All my former rage boiled up again. I could actually feel acid rising in my gullet. I so badly wanted to hit her, again and again, to wipe that smile off her face, for good. They jerked her along towards Dr. Bairstow's office. I watched them go in. Mrs. Partridge's office was empty. Markham was leaving nothing to chance in the hostage-taking possibilities, although, frankly, you'd have to have the biggest death wish in the world to try anything with Mrs. Partridge. Then the door closed behind them, and I was alone on the gallery. I was suddenly conscious of a very great need to see Leon. I called him up.
Are you all right?
Yes, he said. Have they got her?
They have. Quick and quiet.
There was a pause.
Max, I can't come to you. We're still on lockdown.
I know, I said. I'm fine. I was worried about you.
I'm fine too, but you should go and talk to Peterson. Find out how he is.
Shit.
I'd forgotten about Peterson. It was too late anyway. I don't know where she came from, but as I looked across the gallery, Miss Lingos was just closing his door behind her.